Dr. Locke, Willie Bentz, the commissioners, discussing the next step in our battle, for lack of a better word, with the virus. 9:45. KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners' weekly meeting for this week's public health updates on COVID-19, live from the Jefferson County Courthouse. This is KPTZ, Port Townsend.
I think half of the last 8 were caught through asymptomatic pre-screening before procedures, and that's great when we're getting that population that aren't showing any symptoms They still aren't testing anybody that wants to test, but anybody that's symptomatic should call the hotline and will likely get a test because we want to know. Kate, do you want to take a minute to run through your last week, or do you want to wait?
I am muted.
Maybe instead I'll take this time because, Greg, I've been hoping to have an opportunity to tell you this for some time. Met with Mallory Weinheimer, who's working on our sustainable forestry plan, last week, and got the update from her, which I can fill you in on when we have more time. But a big part of that contract was to be doing community outreach so that when people saw active forestry harvest happening on county lands, which is largely maintenance and thinning, much needed thinning for forest health, the public would have had an opportunity to learn about what we're doing and not react like we often see people do when there's a massive clear cut, which, again, is not what we're going to be doing. But she was expressing some disappointment that there will not be an opportunity to do the open houses that she was planning to do to fill in the public. Mm-hmm. So I volunteered you, Greg, to see it, suggest that maybe a video would be a good way to give her a platform to talk about the sustainable forestry. So if that's something you're willing to do, be great to follow up with her.
Yeah, I will. I'm happy to do that, wherever I can amplify. We need find new ways to communicate with the public now, so I'm happy to support that.
Great, thank you. And the harvest is set to take place this late summer or early fall, so the timing is perfect as well.
Okay, I'll reach out to her and see if we can't plan something out.
Great, thanks so much.
All right. It is past 9:45, and we're joined by our KPTZ listeners, as well as our health officer, Dr. Locke, and our Department of Emergency Management, Willie Bentz. Welcome, gentlemen. And without further ado, we will pass it off for our weekly update to Dr. Locke. Thanks for being here.
Hey. Well, thank you, and good morning to everyone. Well, certainly the news is not good in terms of the coronavirus pandemic. Internationally, the case count continues to go up. So we're over 11 million confirmed cases now in the world, over 500,000 deaths. Some countries are really doing an excellent job, have almost eradicated coronavirus. Places like New Zealand and Taiwan, Vietnam, they are having days where single digit case counts or no cases at all. But the U.S. is decidedly not on that list of countries that have controlled this. In fact, we are now officially the worst affected nation in the world. We have over 2.8 million confirmed cases. We think that's just the tip of the iceberg. There are probably 10 times that many true cases. The death count is over 132,000. What we have going on in the U.S. now is there are single states in the U.S. who have more activity than entire countries in Europe. The especially hard hit states, and people should factor this in if they're making summer travel plans. Texas, Arizona, Florida, things are really out of control in those states right now. Arkansas, Alabama, north of South Carolina also are really not in control from a public health standpoint. That is to say, their rates are going up and up on a day-to-day basis. And although many of those states have pulled back on some of their reopening plans, they still have not gone back to full lockdown. And here in Washington, we were one of the states that where we had stabilized things, but now in the last couple weeks, the rate of increase is going up. The so-called reproductive number, R0, is above one in both Eastern Washington and Western Washington, meaning that every case of coronavirus generates more than one additional case. So the epidemic is increasing. About the only good news with coronavirus now is that the death rate has been going down substantially. It now typically is below 500 deaths a day in the entire country. And that's in contrast to what was going on, over 2,000 deaths a day at the peak of things in March and April. And we know by and large why that's happening. First of all, we're seeing less and less older and high-risk individuals getting infected, and they're the most likely to die from it. We're seeing a dramatic increase in young people, people in the 20 to 39-year age group. That's not a good thing, but at least and they're by no means immune to complications or need for hospitalization or even at risk of death. But their death rate is much lower than older populations. And then finally, and very significantly, we are getting better at treating COVID-19. So the survival rate is going up for people even who have the most severe complications. The survival rate for people on ventilators is going up. In the early days of this, only about 20% of people who were put on ventilators survived. Now the majority are surviving. And we think we'll get better and better at this. This is how medicine works. People don't like the term medical practice, but it's true. You know, we learn through experience and new drugs will be available. This is not to encourage people to do anything reckless and get infected, but it's our goal in healthcare to that everyone survive. That's what we are shooting for. So here in Jefferson County, it was a little confusing to people. Our case count went up to 39, and then it dropped to 38. And the reason for that was cases get assigned based on county residents. So we actually, that 39th case was a real person. It's just that their legal address was another county. So they came off our case count, went on to King County. But then over the weekend, we had three additional cases. So it hasn't quite shown up on the different state and local tallies yet, but as of the end of today, our case count will be up to 41. And still, though, we are doing a lot of tests in Jefferson County. We've now done over 3,200 tests, so our positivity rate is currently at 1.2%, and that contrasts with almost 6% at a statewide level. That is one thing that's driving our case count as well. It's just the very aggressive testing we're doing, which is exactly right. That's what we want to be doing. We want to try to find every case, and because every case we find gives us an opportunity to prevent that infection from spreading to someone else. Something we know pretty conclusively now is that the upswing in cases in the U.S. is not driven by the racial justice protests that started at the end of May. And for that reason, and in response to a KPTZ listener, we're not recommending that everyone who's been in a demonstration get tested. They did that for a while in Seattle. Fortunately, they did not find increased case numbers for that. So that tells us some important things. Being outdoors is much safer than being indoors. Short contact with other people is much safer than prolonged contact. And wearing a mask, as most protesters were doing, is also very protective. What is going on, and what I think is a very good case study in the epidemic that we're facing now, is what's going on at the University of Washington. So we have an outbreak going on there. It's probably going to get larger, but as of right now, there are 121 UW students. 112 of them live in fraternity houses, and then the nine others are close contacts. So this is an outbreak associated around, you know, drinking and frat parties, and it's spilled over into other counties, including Jefferson County. So now three of our cases in Jefferson County are linked to this fraternity outbreak. One person who actually attended a party there, and then two people who were infected in Jefferson County from that case. And this is kind of the pattern we're seeing, is people who have out-of-town exposures or have visitors from out-of-town, usually family members who actually come in and stay with them and who are infected without knowing it. So we've had several confirmed cases of that going on. We've had household contacts who were exposed to confirmed cases who became infected. They were exposed before their household member knew that they were infected. So it wasn't something they really had an opportunity to prevent. And these are really the high-risk situations. When you are indoors for prolonged periods of time with people who are unmasked, we're seeing that in bars, bars are probably the highest risk situation for transmission right now of anything we know. It's just that it's all the worst things. Close contact, poor ventilation, shouting above crowd noise or music going on, and probably the effects of alcohol do not increase safety or infection control practices. That's kind of what we're learning about transmission at this point. On the masking front, there's been several developments, and with each passing week, really at this point, even each passing day, the evidence of how important this is as a control strategy continues to grow. We're really now fully appreciating the benefit of masking as a source control method, where we think we can prevent in excess of 95% of transmissions. So of these 40% or so of COVID-19 cases who are either asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic, if they're wearing a mask, they have a dramatically reduced risk of spreading that infection to someone else. And this also applies to the young people we're seeing, who often are not asymptomatic, but they're very mildly symptomatic. They don't have fevers. They've got some of our recent cases, the only thing, headaches, fatigue, sometimes mild nasal congestion, that just seem like allergies or a common cold, but in fact they tested positive. After all this time, still our most effective control strategies are masking plus physical distance, plus the hand washing, and avoiding contaminated surfaces. On the issue of masking mandates, the number of states that have official masking mandates is growing to, I believe it's 46 now. It's probably going to be all states will have some form of mandate within the next week or two. Here in Washington State, so we've had, it started with the directive I put out at the end of May, and then shortly after, on June 8th, Governor Inslee put out a mandate that employers and employees need to wear masks. Not long after that, the Secretary of Health put out a general mandate to Washington State residents that did have a misdemeanor penalty clause. And then the latest step in this progression was announced last week and takes effect tomorrow. And this is sort of the strongest one of all, and that is it's what we call a no mask, no service. So businesses are prohibited from providing services to unmasked individuals, unless you're not covered by the masking mandate. So if you're a young child, if you have a developmental disability and cannot tolerate a mask, if you have a medical exemption, that is allowed. But people with medical exemptions that does not mean that you can, it does not diminish your risk of spreading the infection if you have it to anyone else. And so what businesses are required to do is to offer accommodations to people who cannot wear masks. So to do things like curbside service or a delivery of whatever it is you need, or what I recommend is have someone who is able to wear a mask do your shopping for you. The whole issue of medical exemption to masking is a controversial one because medically it's very hard for us to find any conditions that physically do not allow a person to wear a mask. This is not based on recent evidence. We have been using masks for source control for decades in medicine. Every flu season, anyone who's come into a clinic and has had a cough or a cold probably remembers having a mask slapped on them for the duration of their clinic visit. And this is including, very frail elderly people, people with advanced heart and lung disease. They tolerate masks just fine. We have people wear masks in hospital when they're in rooms, and they tolerate it fine. So really, that although in theory there could be some kind of medical exemption or medical condition that prevents you from being able to wear a mask, those conditions are very rare. Most likely, if a condition exists, it's psychological. It's people who develop panic attacks, people who are assault survivors who may have anxiety reactions. And these are things that are very real, but they're also treatable. People can learn to deal with things that cause panic reactions. There are ways to get past that because a reality of the current situation is that people who do not wear masks are not going to be able to do everything they want to do. And something that's especially disturbing is this. We're seeing this trend on the internet where people can download and print out cards that, you know, say you've got a medical condition and you're not going to tell anyone what it is because that's covered by the Americans with Disability Act. And all of that stuff is just plain bogus. There's no constitutional right to spread infectious diseases to other people. And as the governor said, wearing a mask shows that you care about others and the welfare of others. Not wearing one really says the exact opposite. And the sign I liked, I saw it in Port Angeles this week. A face mask is not a political statement. It's an IQ test. And that's what we want to do. We want to raise the IQ of everyone on this issue. Is if you can't, if you feel you can't wear a mask, let us help you get past that. Because we, it's just the nature of this pandemic that if we're going to control this, we're going to do it through universal masking. There was actually a business journal study that was published this last week that said the U.S. could save 5% of its GDP, which is $1 trillion, just by universal masking. And so, you know, bottom line, people should be wearing masks at all times indoors when you're with non-household members. Outdoors, if you can't maintain the 6-foot buffer. And I would reassure people, you know, who are walking on sidewalks and if they come within 6 feet of someone without a mask for a very short period, that's not something to worry about. Those kind of very transient outdoor exposures seem to be very low risk. And so it's really the more concentrated indoor exposures that we're concerned about. But people who want to prevent getting this infection need to stay away from unmasked non-household members. That appears to be the most effective thing to do. So quickly, I'll just try to answer a few KPTZ questions that I didn't work into the presentation. There was a question about people still finding it hard to be tested. The system in Jefferson County is all testing goes through the hospital, and there's a specialized hotline that screens people, and we are carefully following the state's guidelines for these, and the guidelines are changing week by week. Our current guidelines came out on June 28th. That's what we're using. So we're essentially testing anyone with any kind of symptoms that would be consistent with COVID-19. We were testing some contacts of confirmed cases. Now we test all contacts of confirmed cases, just a question of timing. And we are doing more asymptomatic testing, mostly of people before they have certain kinds of procedures that might result in aerosolized secretions. There was a question, can you do tests prematurely? Can tests be negative and then turn positive? And absolutely. The incubation time for COVID-19 is 2 to 14 days. And most people start to develop either symptoms or a positive test around 5 to 6 days after exposure. So for contacts who have no symptoms, we usually wait 7 days after exposure before we do testing. But if we test too early, a person with the infection can test negative. There's just not enough virus in their system for us to pick it up. There was a good question asking for the apparent inconsistency that, you know, we let people who test positive go back to work or they're out of isolation in 7 days after the onset of their symptoms. And It's a little more complicated than that, but that's fundamentally true. So it's 7 days between from when your symptoms first began or you tested positive, at least 3 days from when your fever disappeared and your symptoms substantially improved. So we call it the 7+3 guideline. So sometimes it's longer than 7 days, but it's 7 days at a minimum, but it can be longer if your symptoms are prolonged. And that the person that wrote in the question said, well, how can this be if some people, their test remains positive for 21 days or longer? And that was something that in the early stages of the pandemic we were concerned about, because not people can have a positive PCR test for up to 60 days after first onset. But now we know pretty conclusively that even those people who shed the virus, or we can detect it for up to 8 weeks, they're not infectious after about 8 days. The PCR test is so sensitive that it can pick up fragments of the virus. And it also may mean that what it's picking up is virus that is attached to antibodies. So we know pretty conclusively that people are no longer infectious after that 7 to 10 day period, even though their test is still positive. I think I answered the other question, the question about businesses offering accommodations. I think this is going to be a challenge to businesses, and it's a challenge we want to help them with wherever we can. But this is really our goal. Our goal is to have masking at levels of 90% or greater indoors, 100% would be ideal. I told the paper I went to the Safeway and Squim on Friday. I walked all around the store. I was doing a masking survey in addition to getting some groceries. And I only saw one person in that entire store. And the store was, it was a busy day. But every single person was wearing a mask, with the exception of one person. And that was a gratifying sight. And it would be a great day if that was the experience of everyone going into a grocery store and other indoor stores, if everyone was masked. People would feel safer, we could bring this under control. Because in my final remark, and probably as most people know, because of the increased activity going on in Washington State, the governor's put a hold on the phased reopening. So whereas Jefferson County's application did go in a week ago, it's not being acted on. They just paused that whole process for a minimum of 2 weeks until things get under better control in the state, and I agree with that approach. You know, it's the fundamental mistake that these the states that are having uncontrolled outbreak activity made is they reopened before they had the virus under control. So we don't want to make that mistake in Washington State. We want to get it back under control, and then we can resume a safe reopening. So I'll leave it at that for remarks, but as always, happy to try to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Locke. Go ahead, Bill.
So hopefully I'm not muted. Okay. A couple of questions, Dr. Locke. One is, what is the frequency for medical personnel and dentists to be tested to know if they are asymptomatic and to isolate or to quarantine?
Currently, we're testing healthcare workers based on exposures. So if they have an exposure to a known case, even if there's masking involved. So if there's a institutional exposure that occurred, such as occurred, you know, and was publicized in Port Angeles, and OMC had a exposure within the hospital. So over 300 hospital employees got tested as a result of that. So we do it in that situation. There are some situations where we routinely test staff. So in nursing homes now, staff are being tested every 2 weeks, and it's kind of an experiment, you know, because we're trying to find the best way to prevent outbreaks in nursing homes. We may start doing that at some point in healthcare facilities, but we're not doing it right now. We're just seeing outbreaks, asymptomatic cases among healthcare workers are still relatively rare. But where people and hospitals that are running ICUs that have a lot of COVID patients, the staff ends up getting tested a lot in those situations because based on exposure risk rather than just a routine asymptomatic screen.
Sure. What about dental staff? You know, they're right there breathing into your face or you're breathing into theirs.
Well, dental staff are wearing N95 masks, so they are wearing the highest grade of masks. We're not routinely testing them. We are testing the patients.
I was going to ask, so before you go for a tooth cleaning or getting a filling, do you get tested?
Jefferson Healthcare is doing it. Private dentists are not mandated to do that. There's not a requirement, but Jefferson Healthcare's dental clinic is doing it. I think you know, if testing is available, it's a good idea. So far in the Olympic Peninsula, our percentage of people tested asymptomatically who are positive has been very low. Probably a tenth of 1%, but it's, you know, it's something we're trying to find new ways to find infection. So that's one of it. But those kind of things, because they do have an experimental quality to them, we're trying to, you know, it may turn out that it's not a good use of resources, and we'll try something different. But right now, that's what we're doing. You know, I understand when people are thinking, well, why don't you test healthcare workers more often? To be really effective, we have to virtually do it every day. Mm-hmm. And people need to remember this is not a 100% sensitive test. So this is a test that has false negatives, that people can be tested and in fact have the infection, but the test doesn't pick it up. So it's not, if we had a 100% sensitive test, we might treat it differently, but now we just have, it's not a good use of the resource. Testing, although people are not being charged for it, is not free. It costs about $100 to do a COVID-19 test. So as we do thousands and thousands of tests, that is a lot of resource.
Mm-hmm. Great. And then in terms of when the state starts processing phase three applications again, will our health department need to refresh all the documentation, essentially submit a new application?
We don't know yet. I think not. I think that certainly not a new application. We probably will have to refresh our case data, which is fairly straightforward to do. We may need the hospital to recertify their stockpiles of personal protective equipment. which is also, they keep very close tabs on that. So that, but I don't think we'll have to, that all the things about the application that haven't changed, I don't think we'll need to resubmit. But the state has not officially told us when they unpause the applications what they're going to want from us.
Okay, thank you.
On that, Dr. Locke, I mean, this two-week number from the governor is a guideline, but it's going to be data-driven. Is that correct, Sean, when they open this up?
Yeah, I think what they're saying is at least 2 weeks. So 2 weeks at a minimum.
Okay. Great. Dave or Kate, any other questions for Dr. Locke today?
I'm just curious, Dr. Locke, and this, you know, this came up in our Board of Health deliberations, too. You know, the feeling that folks, I think I've even heard it referred to as a right to be eating in restaurants again. And in seeing the, for example, the New York Times headline today, just about across the country, the kind of racial disparities that we're seeing of this disease, I'm wondering, do you know, is that linked to service workers at all, folks in, working in restaurants, you know, who are basically serving unmasked people because they're eating or drinking all day long? Is there an uptick in incidence with service workers in general? Is that a higher risk activity?
Absolutely. We most see it in food processing plants across the board. So not just meat packing, but agricultural food packing plants. That's really what's driving things in Yakima right now. But any time you have an indoor exposure to an unmasked person, you are at risk of acquiring the infection. And the mask you're wearing gives you some protection, but not enough. You know, restaurant workers would have to wear N95 masks in order to get the maximum protection. And number one, we don't have enough N95 masks to do that. And number two, it would be really uncomfortable for people to try to work in those. See, so N95 masks have a lot of resistance to your breathing. So they are uncomfortable to wear for most people. But yes, that is an exposure risk. And, you know, we're kind of reconsidering some of the safety issues about indoor dining. And especially this notion that being in a restaurant is kind of a get out of wearing a mask free card sort of event, because people should be wearing their mask when they order, when they're just chatting at the table. Really, the only time they should remove their mask is, you know, when they're putting something in their mouth, food or liquid. And that's not what people are doing. People are going and just, you know, they want to get back to normal. And I understand that psychologically, but things are not normal. And what we are learning as a nation is that magical thinking is not a pandemic control plan. Is you have to change the things you're doing at least enough to control the infection. And other countries have done that. It's not as if this is impossible. Far from it. It's very possible to do it. It's just that we are not doing it as a country, and we need to change that because we are still a long ways from having a vaccine.
Dr. Locke, I heard about a letter going around, I think, doctors and scientists this weekend asking for more research on the aerosolized droplets. And now maybe some people are theorizing that not just when I'm talking or shouting, it's projecting out, but perhaps, you know, kind of like the measles outbreak, you know, that seemed huge last year in Clark County, that aerosol might hang in the air for an extended period of time. Can you speak a little bit to that? And is that something that we should, is that still early to be acting on?
Well, it's most people who study this now agree that there is an aerosol phase of coronavirus transmission. It does not seem to be near as bad as measles or tuberculosis, where the infectious material can float around for hours after a person's been in the room. It can get into ventilation systems and move elsewhere. But it's pretty clear that for 8 to 14 minutes and in this immediate vicinity of a person who's talking, that there is this kind of fine mist that's generated that floats in the air. And it can hold enough virus that if the exposure is long enough, that people can get infected. And that's why we use this criteria. 15 minutes within 6 feet is if the person's not coughing or visibly ill. So how we change our practices to accommodate this is a big issue. And probably one of the biggest issues is in healthcare settings. Should we go to universal N95 masks? And some would very much like to do that, but we still as a nation do not have enough N95 masks, which is a scandal of a completely different kind. We could be making enough now, but we're not. We're still getting the majority of our masks from foreign countries. I think the organizations like the World Health Organization, they're kind of slow. They're very deliberative, in some ways bureaucratic organizations that change their standards slowly. But the science right now is moving very rapidly, and especially this aerosol science. And my personal conclusion is, yes, there is an aerosol transmission route. It's rooms are, but I think we're talking about minutes, not hours, in terms of environmental contamination. And importantly, masks are a very effective way of trapping these aerosols. And it doesn't take anything sophisticated. That's why these very simple cloth masks are enough. I got a question over our Facebook page at the county as to why viruses are very small. How can a mask possibly stop a virus from being admitted or emitted? And the answer is the virus is not there all by itself. It's in a droplet. It's attached to a particle, and these particles are not moving in straight lines. They move in what's called Brownian motion, which is this kind of random zigzagging motion, and so they collide with the fibers in masks, and the vast majority, 99% of the particles hit a strand of fiber and get trapped because they're moist. And so this incredibly simple control device turns out to be highly effective. But the more evidence that supports aerosol transmission, the more important masking becomes, both for source control and for protection of high-risk individuals.
Great, thank you. One other follow-up on something you said before. I mean, do we have enough surgical masks now? Should food service workers be looking for something that isn't just source control, but is something more protective for them as well?
Well, there's an argument for that, and the surgical mask supply has improved greatly. So now it's easy to get surgical type masks, blue masks, in hardware stores and online, and so they're fairly readily available, and people can use those as alternatives to cloth masks. We still encourage cloth masks from a sort of a supply standpoint. They're reusable. You can launder them. the more ecological. But if people want to wear blue surgical masks, that's their right. And it's true they have improved filtration. Their filtration is probably around 50 to 60%, as opposed to a cloth mask, which is down around 20% or so.
Okay, thank you. Any last questions for Dr. Locke? All right. Well, thank you as always for the information, and we'll pass it off to Willie Bentz for an update from DEM.
Awesome. Thank you, Commissioner. So as of last week, all 18,000 of our masks for low-income Washingtonians have been delivered to partner agencies who will then, of course, distribute those to their clients, including a couple of organizations out in Forks who serve residents on Jefferson County's West End, so making sure that we're hitting everyone and making those available. I know Christopher Brotherton specifically appreciates that. The state EOC has ordered the smaller sized masks for children. So those are on their way to the state warehouse. Exactly what our allocation is, we don't quite know yet, but we should expect to have those in hand within the next week or two. So we'll make sure to get those out specifically to partner agencies who can distribute to those who, again, require that little bit smaller of a size that's more useful for children. We still don't have a decision from the state unified command as to whether or not they're going to support the distribution through the state of the masks with that clear plastic window for those who interact with the deaf or the hard of hearing, or for folks in courts have asked, in the court system have asked about those masks, so you can actually see someone's full face when testifying. So since we haven't heard, we're likely going to look at ordering those here in the next day or two to make available next week. And we'll order a small amount and see what the demand is like, since we don't know yet. But a couple of folks have expressed interest in those. All told, through the work of our logistics section, they've distributed about 70,000 pieces of PPE over the course of the past couple months. And have another 40,000 currently in stock that have either been committed to an agency that we're holding on to, or PPE that we're holding in reserve here for distribution during a surge. So well over 100,000 pieces. So really thank them for their work there. As far as the PPE front goes, all of our partner agencies still have a stock in at least the 2-week, 3-week range. They're continuing to ration, although use has ramped up. Those supply chains have opened up a little bit more, so we're still sitting relatively good there. However, one thing not just here locally but across the nation folks are starting to reckon with is that it's the summer season, which means hurricane season in a lot of places in the U.S., as well as wildfire season in other places. So just for example, firefighters who deploy to a wildland fire are going to be required to carry 14 masks with them on their deployment. So our partner agencies, our 5 fire jurisdictions, are currently kind of assessing their stock to see if they can support their firefighters when and if they deploy. So we'll be working with them to supply them with any additional PPE that they need. And we're also kind of looking at, too, the Red Cross is talking about how you manage and set up a shelter, a disaster shelter, as people are fleeing a hurricane, fleeing a wildfire, while maintaining safety during a global pandemic. So we're still kind of looking into some of those issues. And a lot of learning on the fly, but we unfortunately can't pause those other disasters while we deal with the pandemic. So if Dr. Locke has a pause button, now would be the time to let me know. Other than that, our planning section team, other than kind of working on some of that contingency planning for other disasters, for a potential second surge, they're continuing on with the mask surveys. I've gotten some folks who've complained a little bit, saying, "Hey, I went to this store or that store, and my experience did not match up with what you're saying at all." And I totally understand that. Your mileage may vary. Our surveys are kind of a snapshot in time. However, our planning team, they've surveyed nearly 1,000 individuals over the course of the past couple of weeks as they've been doing this mask survey. They do hit up different stores, different times of day, and do take rough counts of folks in the stores. As of last week, they were seeing about 90 to 95% masking compliance in our stores. Some of the other problem areas I had mentioned earlier, certain retail outlets that were honestly down near the 50 to even 60% mark. Those have come up quite significantly. And again, as Governor Inslee's new order takes effect tomorrow, we're hoping that 95%+ even creeps even higher, closer to the 100% Dr. Locke mentioned you would really like to see. I'm kind of disappointed to report that compliance rate was among customers. It was actually slightly lower among employees. They noticed that was down closer to the 90% as opposed to the 95%, closing in on 100% range. So that order has been in effect for quite a while, requiring employees to wear masks and their employers to provide them. So we really just want to reinforce that, especially since those folks, as Commissioner Dean had talked and asked about, those are the folks at the highest risk since they're interacting with a lot of people each and every day. I will also make my pitch. I mentioned this last week, and I'll make it kind of a routine pitch. Not only is wearing a mask important, wearing it correctly is important. There's a rough segment of folks who do have a mask on or around their face, but whether it's covering their mouth and their nose completely is often a different story. So the mask is really only effective when it's covering both your mouth and your nose and catching all those droplets. So please make sure it's not just over your mouth with your nose showing, or even worse, down around your chin or your neck. Other than that, I will just share one resource I learned of just a little bit earlier today, and that's the fact that if you want ongoing updates from the state about coronavirus, both in terms of what's opening or what's currently open, all sorts of different information, you can sign up for text updates through the state, and all you have to do is text coronavirus, just one word, coronavirus, to 211-211. That's coronavirus, 211-211. And you can sign up for automated text updates. It gives you the option to select, whether or not you're a business owner or just a private residence, all that kind of fun stuff. So another just great source of information, ability to kind of stay updated on a routine basis. And if you want more information on that specifically or anything else from the state, coronavirus.wad.gov kind of continues to remain the state's core database for anything and everything coronavirus related. So I always encourage folks to check out the website. That's it from the EOC for this week, unless there are any questions.
Go ahead, Bill.
Willie, on your surveys of stores and customers, is that geographically distributed, so hitting Hadlock, Quilcene, and other places?
Yeah, making sure to hit all major grocery stores, retail outlets throughout the county, as well as gas station convenience stores. And yeah, we're making sure not to hyper focus on population centers, but we're definitely looking at Hadlock, Port Ludlow, Quilcene, etc.
Go ahead, David.
Any updates regarding sheltering the homeless? And one question that's come to my mind is, being a disaster or a pandemic, does that give the county any more legal options in terms of like getting out of leases or licensing agreements? Maybe that's a legal question, but I thought maybe you might have covered it.
Yeah, so just on the legal portion, there are certain powers that are attributed to both the county health officer as well as the DEM director during a disaster. However, on the homeless front issue, that's something that we're really looking for a long-term sustainable solution for. That's going to be a larger community conversation outside of just the emergency operations center. So that's something that we are looking at the new Intergovernmental Coordinating Council, I believe is the semi-formal name of that group, to have that conversation on a larger community scale. For the time being, the homeless shelter, at least for the next month, will remain at the fairgrounds. But that's both, not sustainable on a couple of different fronts, including cost. So we're talking about potential, working with the American Legion to make that safer for the population there, to provide for social distancing or at least a solid, safe alternative. But there, again, are larger long-term issues at play. So we're going to kick that up to that Intergovernmental Coordinating Council and get a stronger community engagement in that conversation. Phillips.
Excuse me, Willie. I think we talked about that really coming back to the Joint Oversight Board and the county commissioners. The ICG and ICC are not the venue that have identified housing as one of their topics. So I think it's through the Joint Oversight Board.
My apologies.
And so, David, really it's the JOB that needs to be working with OLECAP and other providers and really taking the lead on that.
That's really discouraging considering how little money we have, and I'm not sure what authority we have in terms of doing things besides just making a plan with targets. So,
well, any revenue are available, for example, through the Coronavirus Relief Fund and others would also be at disposal. So that's, you know, something that JOB can have discussions about. But those also are very limited and time limited, don't address next winter, for example.
Right. And I'm just not sure that we're staffed enough on the Housing Task Force to take that job over, or the Joint Oversight Board. I don't know that we've got capacity to do that. And that is one of the issues ongoing with, I mean, that's the reason we license or lease our properties, is we don't have the capacity to be landlords for them. And we really aren't increasing our capacity much. So that's more conversation needed, yeah.
Okay.
I just have a quick question about masking, and this could be for Willie or for Dr. Locke. But I have also been gratified to see just observationally an increase in mask use. And you've heard me talk about being interested in kind of the psychology of why, what motivates people to wear them or not. And you know, hearing things, for example, the pretty steep rise in cases in Yakima County, and as soon as the masking directive came, it was pretty quickly reversed or slowed. And, you know, so hoping that people are able to hear that kind of evidence and data and change their behavior, but also seeing that just the kind of social norm, that the more we get used to wearing them, the more we get used to seeing them on people, the more comfortable we are, and there seems to be a self-reinforcing societal acceptance. And just curious, are you hearing that if data is driving people to wear them more, or if that kind of social pressure? Do we understand what is gaining us more compliance in masking?
I'll jump in first real quick, and I'll say that for a lot of the folks who are resistant to masking, I don't know if as the data paints a more and more complete picture, I don't know if that is a huge influence, since I think those are the folks who kind of, you know, maybe reject that data when they first see it. I don't know if more evidence is necessarily what's going to be convincing them. I do think that societal pressure that you're talking about, you know, the sideways glances in stores to folks who aren't wearing a mask, I think that eventually is, okay, maybe I'll go ahead and put this on, kind of thing. I will say that this is something, too, that they saw during the 1918 influenza pandemic, that wearing a mask wasn't considered the masculine thing to do. It didn't make you much of a manly man to wear a mask. And I think that there was a subsection of the American population that feels the same way during this pandemic. But again, as more and more people are wearing them, they're getting more and more kind of peer pressure to put that on. I think that is helping quite a bit. As is the fact, too, I think as we're learning more that, again, the mask I wear doesn't protect me, it's protecting others. I think people are being properly guilt-tripped and shamed into protecting the vulnerable just by wearing a simple piece of fabric above their mouth and nose. So I think those societal pressures are really, really working. And I do think the masking mandates Honestly, just the threat of a penalty, the threat of not getting served at a restaurant or in a grocery store too, is just adding another little bit of motivation. So I'd say the societal pressure, the legal pressure, and then finally the data third. But that's just kind of my perspective, if Dr. Locke wants to add on to that.
No, I agree with all that. And I believe that that normative kind of pressure is one of the most effective things we have going. To me, one of the disturbing aspects of this is this kind of partisan ideologic dimension to it, which is really unique in the U.S. No other country is turning this into a political statement. And it is the most wildly dysfunctional thing I can imagine, is to take the cheapest, safest control strategy for a pandemic and turn it into this emblem of personal freedom or political identity. And we just really have to get beyond that, because right now people are getting very mixed messages about this. They are seeing these national rallies and all these people who are not masking, and it's really making people feel like, is this a real thing or not? Very sensible, reasonable, but people are asking themselves, is this really necessary? And we just have to keep pushing on that. And one of the reasons that the ideologic part of it is disturbing is typically people do not change their ideologies. And we see kind of a disturbing crossover between the anti-vaccination folks and the anti-maskers. So the anti-vaxxers and the anti-maskers really have a lot of shared views, and it's basically that the government has no role in controlling communicable diseases. And in fact, from my perspective as a public health professional, this is one of the fundamental duties of government, is health, safety, welfare, is why government exists.
Great. Any last questions or comments? I will throw one cultural comment on there. When I was a long time ago in 97 living in South Korea as a teacher, I was surprised the first couple times I saw kids come into class wearing surgical masks and wondering why they were. And it's, they were wearing their masks because they had a little bit of a cold, not enough to stay home. But, that kind of cultural consideration is has been building in other areas for a long time. And I guess I feel optimistic about the progress we've made, while recognizing we're not all the way there. And it's just so critical and so easy to do. And, it's a struggle even with my own child, getting him to go out. And if you're going to hang out with your friend, I know you're going to be within 6 feet, so just wear a mask. And it's a hard conversation that I've had to have many times with my own family. So it's not an easy thing to do necessarily to make this switch, but we just got to keep pushing it. So last call for questions or comments. Otherwise, we'll say thank you very much to Dr. Locke and Willie Bintz. We will see you next week, and take care. Be safe. Mask up.
Thank you.
Bye, guys, and thank you to the listeners of KPTZ. Did we address all their questions?
And this is KPTZ, Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of County Commissioners meeting at the courthouse.